For listeners who are blind, have low vision, or have another print disability, which makes reading, holding a book, or turning a page difficult or impossible. The content is copyrighted by the respective publishers. For more information, please visit us on the web at nfradioreading.org.
Hello, this is Robin, and for the next hour, I'll be reading from current issues of the Lockport Union Sun and Journal on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. First, from Tuesday, October 14th. Wineries offer murder mystery, corn maze, and chef's dinner. Events scheduled throughout the fall. Written by Heidi Tricia Light. Niagara County wineries offer a variety of fall events to go along with the fruits of their labor and scenic country views. Tickets for the Niagara Wine Trail's popular Halloween murder mystery on Saturday past are available for purchase until Thursday. Ticket holders get a souvenir wine glass and travel to their choice of 11 participating wineries, where they can enjoy 3 glasses of wine at each and meet a character in the mystery. Once registered for the Halloween event, participants are emailed the character guide and the character's winery location, said Margot Sue Bittner, owner of the winery at Margin Manor, who wrote the whodunit. At each winery, a costume character introduces himself, offers a clue, and answers investigation questions from participants. For this year's event, Bittner will play Gloria Trotter, a local tourism official who is involved in a wine tasting that ended in the death of the judge. Bittner said other characters include a winery owner, a wine server, a grower, a winery worker, and the judge's assistant, all with motives for murder. Some people come in costume, and we all take pictures together, but, Bittner said, we recommend that people start right at noon because it could take up the whole day. When participants have determined the culprit, Bittner said that they use a QR code to submit the character's name for the chance to win a bottle of wine. At the end of the event, Bittner says she posts the killer's name on the Wine Trail's website. Michael Schweitzer, president of the Niagara Wine Trail and owner of Bella Rose Vineyard and Winery, said winery customers are looking for options that are more family-oriented and can accommodate those in their group who aren't drinking alcohol. Black Willow Winery at 5565 Westlake Road in Burt is accepting entries for its pumpkin contest Thursday and Friday from noon to 6 and Saturday from 11 to 6. The contest is open to vine-inspired masterpieces that are carved, painted, or magically bewitched. Voting on winners starts at Sunday and continues until October 25th at 5 p.m. Anthony Manor Winery and Farm at 3671 Human Road in Sanborn opens its corn maze to visitors Friday to Sunday afternoons until November 2nd. The winery also sells pumpkins, corn stalks, and mums. For a fee, art fans can enjoy a sip and paint class on Sunday at 2 p.m. with Terry Seddon at the winery at Margin Manor, located at 7171 Lake Road in Appleton. The class features an image of all fall trees on a path while enjoying wine. On November 13, Arrowhead Spring Vineyards at 4746 Town Line Road in Lockport will offer a chef's dinner featuring 5 courses prepared by Maizal Mexican Kitchen of Amherst with Arrowhead wine pairings. Robin Ross, winery owner, said the menu begins with an avocado jalapeno mousse, moves on to a shrimp and citrus course, an Oaxacan duck confit with white beans, stuffed pork loin and pork belly, and dessert. For additional details, call 716-433-6000. Also from Tuesday the 14th, Mark Russell was elected Farm Bureau President. During the 2025 annual meeting of the Niagara County Farm Bureau, Mark Russell of Alcott was elected president and Max Russell of Appleton was elected vice president. Outgoing president Kevin Bittner recapped local Farm Bureau business during the past year, including a successful chicken barbecue partnership with Cornell Cooperative Extension, a well-attended AG forum, record high sales at the corn booth at County Fair, and providing information on zoning and other issues to farmers. Bittner served as president for 3 years. Meeting guest speaker, Catherine Sly Hernandez, Senior Associate Director of Public Policy for New York Farm Bureau, explained the behind-the-scenes work that goes into making a bill a law. Often, Farm Bureau is approached by farmers with a concern that needs state legislation. Farm Bureau reaches out to the other agricultural organizations in the state to ensure support. The legislative process then begins. Members of the Farm Bureau approach legislators with their concerns and suggestions. As discussions move forward, the legislators might ask for language in which to base the law. Once a bill is written, discussions with legislators continue. There are letters of support, meetings, and various other forms of communication. Sly Hernandez said it takes 8 years on average for a bill to become a law in New York. What you are doing this evening is the first step in our legislative process, she said. Local resolutions go to resolutions committee, then to the state convention. The resolutions passed become our priorities for next year. It is a grassroots process. Resolutions generated during the annual meeting touched on issues including improvement of roads, bridges, and drainage in Niagara County, taxing agricultural districts, New York Farm Viability Institute's farmer support, and testing for biosolids spread on agricultural fields. On the national level, the group supported national standard definitions for sell-by, use-by, and best-before on food labels to ensure a healthy food supply and prevent food waste. The meeting was attended by State Assembly members Angela Moronello and Paul Bologna. Membership in the Niagara County Farm Bureau is open to all farmers, agricultural businesses, and anyone who eats. For more information, go to niagaracountyfarmbureau.com or call 716-735-7791. And that's all they wrote. And finally, from the Tuesday, October 14th issue, exploring the Niagara frontier, fox squirrels are a rare sight in Western New York. A commentary by Bob Confer. Most of my nature library is made up of books I accumulated as a kid. For the most part, they remain accurate because animals and their behaviors really don't change too much over the course of a few decades. Where they do occasionally need revision, though, is in the range maps. Take the fox squirrel, for example. Going back to the middle 1990s, fox squirrels really weren't a thing in Western New York. Back then, if you did see one, your sightings were limited to Chautauqua County. Their traditional range had them living across the entire central U.S. and some of the eastern U.S. south of the New York-Pennsylvania border. Fast forward to 2025. It's a different world. Now, fox squirrels can be found, though still quite rarely, in many parts of Western New York. Perhaps an outcome of the maturation of woodlands that were once farmland. The New York State Department of Environmental Conservation says they can now be found in the Empire State's 8 western counties, with the highest numbers at the shore of Lake Erie and along the Genesee River. But expansion of range doesn't necessarily yield an expansion in numbers. The most recent assessment by the state says that creatures have been confirmed by just 39 NYSDEC records between 2013 and 2024, despite an intensive camera trapping effort. I count myself as lucky, as I get to see them often. We have a sustainable population of them in our woodlot in Gasport, which is prime habitat. They prefer open forest with mature trees and agricultural fields nearby. Outside of my home turf, though, I've seen them on only 3 occasions in Western New York. If you ever see a fox squirrel, you know it because, well, they're different. Let's start with the size. Fox squirrels are massive by the standards set by other Western New York squirrels. They come in at 12 to 15 inches long in the body, 10 to 14 inches long in the tail, and they can weigh from 1.5 to a whopping 3 pounds as adults. That's twice the total length of a red squirrel, and anywhere from 2 to 6 times their weight. As for the larger gray squirrels, with which foxes are often confused, grays are still 1/3 to 1/2 shorter and lighter in length and weight. Those are huge differences. You'll see that in their gait. Whereas red squirrels seem constantly frantic and gray squirrels have a bit of bounce, the fatter fox squirrels are lumbering. Their rather slow, seemingly defenseless posture is intriguing because the reds and grays tend to stay next to or on trees while fox squirrels will walk throughout the forest, often many yards away from trees and even into neighboring hay fields. They slowly search for nuts, acorns, fungi, plant material, and if they're lucky enough, bird eggs. If those two characteristics don't nail identification, consider their coloring. The best way to put it, imagine if a red squirrel and a gray squirrel had a giant freak baby. That would be a fox squirrel. Many have a grayish primary to their coat or fur, which is covered with vast swatches of chestnut hues on the underbelly and on the limbs. Sometimes fox squirrels might even be entirely rusty in appearance. You never know what to expect with their fur. All of that makes them a sight to see, and hopefully it's a sight that stays with us and grows in numbers. Given similar habitat between northwestern Pennsylvania and eastern Ohio, where they are numerous, biologists don't know why they are not more common in Western New York, or why their numbers have declined in cities where they were once more abundant, like Jamestown. As much as we'd like to see their numbers grow, that might not be in the cards. Fox squirrels have a ravenous appetite for mast crops, like nuts and acorns, more so than other squirrels do. As all of the beech trees die off across Western New York, the fox squirrel's territory will be limited to stands of oak trees and hickories if they can find them. With those beeches going along the way of the dinosaur, it's kind of a bad time for fox squirrels to make their advance across the region. It will really impede their progress or even cause them to retreat. So, if you see one of these giant rodents, count yourself as lucky. They're a relatively new addition to our already impressive roster of mammals, but they remain a hard find across the region. And that's all Bob Confer wrote. And now, from Wednesday, October 15, front page, cooking up success Homemade to Money Made program teaches food business basics by Heidi Trishel Light. While working as chefs in New York City, sisters Jamie and Sarah Secor dreamed of returning to Western New York to start a business of their own. Now in their third season operating Edgy Veggie vegan food truck, the Secors implemented the steps they learned at a small business course. Today, Cornell Cooperative Extension from Niagara County, in conjunction with the Niagara Small Business Development Center, will teach the free Homemade to Money Made Business Workshop from 6 to 8 at 4487 Lake Avenue in Lockport. It's the first time the course has been offered since 2018, said Heather Nedrasik, the extension's beginner farmer educator, and space in the class is still available. The workshop is geared toward food production as part of the value-added agriculture, but Nedrasik said it is also relevant for potential food truck businesses, bakers, sauce makers, and food packagers. The session includes a guided tour of the Western New York Food Incubator commercial kitchen on site. So many people have a great family recipe. We're getting an abundance of farm produce, said Bree Bacon, certified business manager at the Niagara Small Business Development Center. They want to learn more about how to legally sell their products and turn it into a business, whether it's starting a farm stand or selling at a farmer's market. We are trying to appeal to people who are canning, Nedrasik said. We did just have somebody call about making her pet food. There's also people that are doing small catering businesses. We're going to go over the basics of getting started. Bacon said the workshop introduces participants to free and low-cost resources and verified information about permits and licenses, business planning, and pricing considerations. Participants will also see the Cooperative Extension's state-of-the-art incubator kitchen, which is a fully licensed commercial kitchen that local entrepreneurs can rent to produce items that either require a commercial kitchen, like pickles, or need more space to scale up production, like baked goods. We want this hands-on workshop to help people turn their passion into a viable product they can sell, Bacon said. The Secors spend a day each week at the incubator kitchen in Lockport to prep a variety of ingredients they use in vegan cooking. Jamie was slicing delicata squash, the main ingredient in a sandwich, on house-made focaccia bread with tempura fried onions and cabbage apple slaw. Sarah was chopping dozens of garlic cloves and moved on to preparing ginger. Jamie said she and Sarah began testing recipes for their food truck while they still worked for other businesses. When they returned to Buffalo, they found an empty Chevrolet Express van and a fabricator in Alden who installed their cooking equipment and stainless steel cladding. They developed their business plan, and a year later they were operating in Erie County during the April to November season. Last quarter, Sarah said their sales had increased 34%. We have repeat customers and customers that come to events just for our food, she said. And that's all they wrote. And now, Parent Network of Western New York launches new program. You are listening to a reading of articles and features from the Lockport Union Sun and Journal on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. And now, Parent Network of Western New York is accepting applications for its new Family Behavior Support Advocacy Program, offering short-term personalized support and guidance to parents and caregivers of a child or young adult with a developmental disability. The program will work with families to develop a goal and identify challenging behaviors and other barriers to reaching that goal. Services can be provided at home, in the community, at school, or online. The goal is to empower caregivers by offering them tools and strategies to better understand and manage their children's behavioral concerns. Family behavior support specialist Jessica Wilson said, "The hope is that by proactively assisting caregivers and their children now, the need for future intensive behavioral programming will be reduced. Although this is not a comprehensive behavior intervention program, this program is still going to make a huge difference helping families who have a loved one with a developmental disability and are experiencing behavior concerns." Parent Network of Western New York Director Kimberly Kedzolka said, "The program is funded by the New York State Office for People with Developmental Disabilities and is available for school-aged children and young adults who have OPWDD eligibility and reside within Erie or Niagara counties. Parent Network of Western New York provides one-on-one support and education on disabilities, special education, and additional services. For more information, visit https://parentnetworkwesternnewyork.org/. And that's all they wrote. And now from the opinions page, also from Wednesday, the 15th of October. How Travel Sports Leave Kids of Color Behind by Sharon Bailey. What happens when talent meets a paywall? For many families of color, youth travel sports are not a path to opportunity. Instead, they are a financial gamble with uneven odds. Youth travel sports were once a rite of passage, fueled by neighborhood games and backyard rivalries. Travel meant piling into borrowed vans or school buses, sharing snacks from home, and chasing competition at Cass County lines. Today, youth travel sports is big business. In 2024, U.S. families spend an average of $1,016 on their child's support, on their child's sport, a 49% increase since 2019, according to the Aspen Institute Parent Survey. That price tag shapes the face of every team, often tilting the scales toward those with deeper pockets. For families of color already dealing with income disparities, these costs create invisible barriers that hurt inclusion before the season starts. Travel baseball and club soccer stand out as exceptions in the world of youth sports. They're the most popular team sports for Black, Hispanic, and multiracial players, thanks to affordable gear and deep community ties. Compared to the $3,000 to $7,000 sum families spend on youth baseball each year, a $1,200 season in soccer or basketball seems more attainable. Soccer's relatively balanced racial split, about 45% Hispanic and 25% Black among boys, shows how cultural connection and manageable costs can open doors to participation. Sports with moderate diversity tell a more complicated story. Travel baseball and softball have seen growing Hispanic rosters, yet white players remain the majority. Though the average baseball season costs around $714, which is about two-thirds of the national average, families must still resort to fundraising and personal financial support to remain competitive due to the added expenses of travel teams and showcase events. Hockey is another thing. Youth travel hockey is among the most expensive sports in America, with families spending an average of $2,500 to 3,000 per season. Some elite programs climb well beyond that. A good pair of skates can cost $150, a composite stick more than $100, and protective gear easily top $600 before a kid even steps on the ice. Between ice time, equipment, league dues, and travel, the sport's financial footprint is enormous. It's not shocking that hockey is mostly a white sport, considering how expensive it is and the limited access to ice rinks in many communities of color. Contrast that with basketball. A single hoop and a used ball can sustain pickup leagues, booster-funded travel teams, and community clinics led by former pros. The lower cost equipment and the high availability of public courts have made hoops the most inclusive of travel sports. But even basketball's model isn't perfect. Club dues, private coaching, and AAU circuit fees can still exceed $2,000 per season, pushing families to stretch every dollar. These divisions aren't just anecdotal. When a family's disposable income is stretched thin by rent, childcare, or medical bills, the extra $200 for private batting lessons or the $150 jersey deposit becomes a decisive hurdle. Soccer occupies a unique middle ground because of the sport's worldwide popularity. Hispanic families in both cities and suburbs are focusing on club participation, though travel and uniforms can cost almost $1,188 each season. Local leagues scramble to secure grant funding, solicit business sponsors, and host community tournaments that double as fundraisers. The outcome? Soccer fields with remarkable racial and ethnic diversity. Despite its growth, Asian participation lags behind Hispanic and Black representation, and white families often hold key coaching and club leadership positions, dictating culture and accessibility from the top. So where does this leave baseball, softball, and hockey? Often on the sidelines. If youth travel sports do not implement targeted outreach, income-based fees, and local mentorship programs, especially those led by people of color, they risk becoming insular and signaling to families of color that they are unwelcome. If travel sports become pay-to-play clubs, kids learn that talent and identity determine access. Courts, fields, and rinks should be essential public resources for municipalities, not high-end rentals. Basketball's community-focused approach and soccer's fundraising events offer valuable lessons for all sports on reducing expenses and increasing coaching diversity. Diversity in travel sports is something you should have to choose. The clock is running, and without action, many young athletes from underrepresented communities will be priced out of play, benched before they ever get to compete. And that's all she wrote. And now, from Thursday, October 16th, front page, giving audiences goosebumps, Taylor Theater hosting stage production later this month by Heidi Trishel Light. It wouldn't be the spooky season without a spooky story, and Goosebumps the Musical provides that at the Taylor Theater from October 24th to 26th. Jason Mustachio, co-founder of the Spotlight Performing Artists of Lockport, the company producing the show, said fans of the Goosebumps books and TV series will enjoy this tale of the Phantom of the Auditorium. The musical, which features 9 cast members from across Western New York, presents the story of high school students putting on a play that is haunted by a phantom. It's a rare opportunity, said Mustachio. It's pretty popular, but this is the first time that this musical is being performed in Western New York. The challenge with the Phantom character is that it's a mystery. There's several characters in the show that could be Phantom, but you don't know until the end. There's a creepy janitor, and his character is so obviously the creepiest character in the show, but you never know. Spotlight Performing Artists is a pre-professional theater company that works mostly with actors who have previous experience, Mustachio said. I think it's going to appeal to third through ninth grades, and then to the moms and dads that grew up on these books. It blends some of the carefree fun of a young performer's show with the sophistication of a professional show. The talent we have in this cast is extraordinary, said director Katie Mustachio. We're proud to showcase both the dedication of our up-and-coming stars and the expertise of our veteran performers. We do our casting based on and best fit together, Mustachio said. It turns out that most of those folks are looking to pursue performing arts down the road. They all have some sort of experience and get to refine their craft without it just being in the classes and camps. Another part of the mission is to cast age appropriately, so teens are played by teens. It's not like a school show where there are adult characters, but we're limited to the student body. Spotlight Performing Artists also manages their own costuming, lights, and effects for productions, Mustachio said. And that's all they wrote. And now, Farmers Market making a move to the Dale Association. We'll be indoors starting November 1st, every first and third Saturday of the month. By Heidi Trisha Light. The Lockport Farmers Market will move indoors to the Dale Association at 33 Ontario Street starting November 1st. The market will run every first and third Saturday of the month from 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. Patrons can use the parking lot on Lock Street or the Canal Street parking lot. I think our location is helpful to the consistency of the market, said Gretchen Doty, the Dale's Senior Center Director. We have a very large parking lot with a handicapped accessible entrance. The space seemed to work well. We've had a really good outpour of vendor response, Grace Platt of Lockport Main Street, which organizes the farmers market. Now the issue is accommodating them in the new space. We're not going to know how the layout works until we get it set up. We believe we can fit 30 to 31 vendors. We would love to accommodate more, but I think for the first market, we're going to go with 25 to 27. I hope to have SNAP, S-N-A-P, up and running for November 1st, so there are no interruptions. Platt said that there would be a vendor show of the space on October 25th. A lot of the food producers are very interested, she said. The farms go with the season. We are anticipating seeing Heartland Organics, Local Roots, Human Farms, McBee's with Lamb, Frost Farms, which does poultry, and Sunset Sky Beef. Platt said that those vendors are likely to be present from November to December. The market is closed in January. You'll find some fresh produce, but it'll be more food products, she said. We have a lot of bakeries that signed up. We definitely want to continue to offer a variety of products. We're really thankful to our meat producers. Mama's Mission will be there, and they do dry dinner products like chili mix. Crafts and artisans are a nice addition to the December market, Platt said, and are welcomed at Easter. It's a good way to shop for Easter baskets. Platt said moving the market was necessary because their former space at Harrison Place was undergoing changes. Unfortunately, building number 3 is still under construction, she said. They have run into a little storage issue, All of the windows for the building are now stored in the space we used. They were hoping to get them installed. They are anticipating another shipment of windows. When I heard the news, I figured we should find a different space. And that's all she wrote. You are listening to a reading of articles and features from Lockport Union Sun and Journal on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. And now, from Friday, October 17, Niagara Emporium Antique Mall expands Niagara location. By Robert Creenan. Had formerly been located at Eastern Hills Mall in Clarence. Almost a year after moving to the town of Niagara, the Niagara Emporium Antique Mall has already expanded its footprint outside of the fashion outlets of Niagara Falls, USA. The co-op had taken over two vacant storefronts next door to it that were home to shoe department and rainbow shops, with the original space at 2016 Military Road, previously a Kirkland's. With the expansion out of necessity completed this September, the store's more than 200 vendors now have more than 28,000 square feet to showcase their goods. The two new ones carry more booths of products and furniture, said Bob Brewer, father of store owner Christian Brewer. Since we opened, it was mostly just showcases, but people want other types of things that don't fit in the showcase. Originally operating out of the Eastern Hills Mall in Clarence, where Macy's had previously been, the Brewers opened their co-op antique store's new location last November. Rob had been involved with other co-ops over the years, including one in the old Summit Mall, before opening up Niagara Emporium, running it before letting his son take over. The Facebook post announcing this move said they want to come back to the Williamsville area in the future. Other antique co-ops vendors can rent a space or cabinet to sell their products. More than 200 different vendors come from as far as Rochester and southern New York State, selling vintage furniture and home goods, old video games, clothes, books, old newspapers, military items, and medieval armor. Brewer said that they have had better customer traffic here in Niagara Falls, thanks to Canadians shopping in the area, along with their already established customer base. The store is open 7 days a week, 11 a.m. to 7 p.m., except for Sundays, when it closes at 6 p.m. And that's all they wrote. And now from the opinions page on Friday, October 17, Why Therapy Matters for DV Perpetrators, Lori Bragg. When discussing domestic violence, much of the focus, rightly so, is on supporting survivors. But to truly break the cycle of abuse, we must also address the underlying issues that those who cause harm must have been unable to resolve on their own. Domestic violence perpetrator intervention programs, often called DV groups or batterer intervention programs, are essential for holding individuals accountable and helping them to change harmful behaviors. These groups provide education, accountability, and peer learning. They focus on challenging beliefs that support abusive behavior and building healthier relationship skills. While these are all vital steps to recovery, research and clinical practice show that group intervention alone is not usually enough to be successful in breaking the cycle of abuse. Many perpetrators also struggle with underlying mental health conditions such as depression and anxiety, which is often masked by anger or aggression, unresolved trauma, or childhood exposure to violence, substance abuse disorders that exacerbate violent behavior, or personality or emotional dysregulation that fuel control and abuse. Without addressing these deeper issues, participants may complete the necessary steps of a DV program, but fail to make meaningful, lasting change. When combined with DV group intervention, individual or psychiatric treatment provides a comprehensive path to change. It takes things a step further to get to the root causes of abusive behavior. For example, depression, PTSD, or substance use can undermine one's progress in a DV group. Mental health treatment ensures these conditions are recognized and treated appropriately. Therapy can also help individuals identify triggers, manage anger, and develop healthier coping skills, thus reducing the likelihood of violent outbursts. In addition, many perpetrators were exposed to violence in childhood. Mental health support allows them to process their own trauma, so they are less likely to repeat the cycle with their own families. DV groups teach responsibility for one's action, but therapy provides a space to explore the deeper why behind these actions, increasing accountability without excusing the harm. Sustained long-term behavioral change requires both skill building and healing. By combining group accountability with individualized treatment, perpetrators have a stronger chance of changing harmful patterns permanently. Domestic violence is never justified, and those who cause harm must be held accountable. But accountability without healing is incomplete. By pairing DV perpetrator groups with mental health treatment, communities can create more effective interventions, ones that not only stop immediate violence, but also prevent future harm. This combined approach is not about offering excuses. It's about building the conditions necessary for real, lasting change. When perpetrators address both their behavior and their mental health, families and communities become safer, healthier, and stronger. The writer, Lori Bragg, is manager of administration for Catholic Charities Behavioral Health. And that's all she wrote. And now, food assistance is safe through October, but it may be at risk if the shutdown continues. By Jeff Mulvihill and Morgan Lee from the Associated Press. A federal program that provides food assistance to 40 million low-income people could be at risk in November if the government shutdown isn't resolved by then. In at least some places, new applications for the program are not being approved, but there's still a lot of uncertainty about the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, known as SNAP, or food stamps, a vestige of a previous incarnation of food aid. Here's a look at where things stand. The food aid benefits one in eight people in the United States. SNAP is a major piece of the nation's social safety net, touching nearly one in eight people in the country each month. They receive benefits on prepaid cards that they can use for groceries. The other big pieces of the safety net, Social Security and Medicaid, are expected to continue paying benefits during the shutdown. But because of the way it's funded, SNAP is vulnerable. In the accounting year that ended on September 30, 2024, SNAP caused just over $100 billion, including the half of state administrative costs covered by federal taxpayers. It provided an average of $187 a month to 41.7 million people. States were warned about November benefits. When the government shut down on October 1, amid a congressional budget impasse, a few things were clear about SNAP. One was that benefits would continue through October. The other is that it was unclear after that. The U.S. Department of Agriculture, which oversees the program, sent letters on October 10th to state agencies that administer it, telling them not to send certain files to the contractors that would clear the way for the EBT cards to be loaded at the start of November. Different states send that information at different points in the month. Carolyn Vega, the Associate Director of Policy Analysis at Share Our Strength, an anti-poverty advocacy group, said that pausing sending the information now doesn't mean that cards can't be loaded next month with or without resumption of government operations, but it's not good news either. The question marks that are trending in a bad direction for November, she said. Finding money during the shutdown could be a challenge. A budget agreement that ends the shutdown would also restore SNAP funding. Short of that, Vega said, it's possible state or federal governments could free up money to bridge the gap. She said, ahead of a looming 2015 shutdown, similar warnings were released and then reversed, even before Congress reached a deal to keep the government running. But because of the amount of money involved, she noted, that's a challenge. General SNAP costs far more, for instance, than the special supplemental nutritional program for women, infants, and children that helps 6 million low-income mothers, young children, and expectant parents to purchase nutritional staples. President Donald Trump's administration has shored up that program, for now, with $300 million. Doing the same for the bigger program could cost about $8 billion a month. And it tends to hundreds of millions of dollars monthly per state. Finding state money to cover costs could also be difficult. Peter Hadler, the Deputy Commissioner of Connecticut's Department of Social Services, told lawmakers in his state Thursday that there could be another problem with trying to do that. He doesn't expect the federal government to ever reimburse states. Hadler also said he expects the EBT network will be shut off at the retail level if the program isn't federally funded. In that case, even people with a balance could not access it. States are figuring out how to react. More than 1 in 5 New Mexico residents receive SNAP benefits at a cost of about $90 million a month. The idea of those benefits disappearing is raising alarms in New Mexico, where more than 1 in 5 people relies on them. I think it's direct harm to New Mexicans, to New Mexico's communities, and New Mexico's economy that is unprecedented, said State Representative Nathan Small, a Democrat and chair of the Maine Budget Writing Committee. But he said it's too early to say whether New Mexico might find options to mitigate any harm if the benefits are cut off. We're following up, Charles Sally, director of the legislature's Budget and Accountability Office, told lawmakers at a hearing Wednesday to verify whether food stamps is really out of money or if this is just a tactic that the administration is playing in the overall negotiation. Minnesota's Department of Children, Youth, and Families told counties and Native American tribes not to approve new SNAP applications after Wednesday, and the state was preparing to tell recipients on October 21st that benefits would not be issued for November, barring any changes. An interruption in receiving food assistance can be very disruptive, even dire, for the lives of Minnesota families. Tiki Brown, the department commissioner, told local officials in the update. Other SNAP changes are starting to kick in. The government shutdown isn't the only development that could cut access to SNAP. The broad policy and tax law that Congress passed and Trump signed in July also calls for changes to the program. Adults with children from 14 to 17 will no longer be exempt from a work requirement to receive benefits, and neither will people ages 55 through 64. Those policies are in effect now, and some people could begin losing coverage around the start of January. And that's all they wrote. You are listening to a reading of articles and features from the Lockport Union Sun and Journal on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. And now, from the Saturday, Sunday, October 1819 edition. Expanding for the stars, Moog embarks on upgrade of Wheatfield Space Propulsion Production Facilities by Robert Creenan. from Wheatfield, with hundreds of rocket launches a year and thousands of satellites orbiting Earth relaying information we all rely on, there's a good chance that what helped them to get to outer space was manufactured by Moog in Wheatfield. Moog's Walmore Road facility assembles and tests thrusters for spacebound craft, with the company looking to ramp up production. The East Aurora-based manufacturer announced last month it would expand its clean room capacity in Wheatfield by 80%, enabling more efficient production of thrusters that help satellites get to and stay in space. With our continued growth in the propulsion business, we needed to expand our current space to accommodate that, said Doug Wehrmeyer, the operations manager for Moog's engines business unit, which will help with thorough throughput and efficiency building our hardware. The expansion is due to be complete by summer 2026, with dozens of new employees having being added in operational and engineering roles to meet this new demand. Most of our products will either go on a satellite or launch vehicle, said Mike Popatic, the general manager for in-space propulsion. Once the launch vehicles get into space, the satellites get deployed, and those satellites can do a variety of different jobs. The new clean room space will be used to retrofit a calibration lab, which is in a different building from the already existing clean rooms. The lab will be moved to a different space in the same building. Papadik said the assembly process for rocket engine hardware and propulsion systems happens in a clean room environment because they cannot be exposed to any debris. Employees working inside the clean rooms will have to wear plastic head covers, gloves, and white gowns. Thruster assembly and testing happen in Wheatfield, while some of the components come from Moog's main Elma facility. That had its own expansion in August with a $6 million, 13,000 square foot training center, which also came due to growth demand in their markets. Papadik did not know how much this latest Wheatfield expansion would cost Moog, but it builds on investments already made over the past 7 years. That included $26 million for 2018 for a space propulsion testing facility. Among the recent space missions that have featured the components are NASA's Artemis missions, with the first one launching in 2022 for a flyby of the moon, and the Perseverance rover that has been exploring the surface of Mars since February 2021. Traveling 55,000 miles an hour, it was our engines that kept it going and staying on course, said Katie Gibas, Moog's marketing communications manager, and being able to survive those 7 minutes of terror to land the rover on the surface. For more earthbound matters, satellites that enable GPS tracking, satellite radio, and satellite TV have also had Moog components to get them into place. Papadik said more than 80% of the company's business is for the U.S. customers, with the rest coming from foreign markets in Europe and Asia. And that's all they wrote. And now, Historical Association of Lewiston hosting Bud Bailey. Buffalo Sports, the topic of Thursday community event, which is a special to the Union Sun and Journal. The Historical Association of Lewiston will host Bud Bailey for its October program. Let's Talk Sports, a conversation with Bud Bailey, will take place at 7 p.m. Thursday at the Lutheran Church of the Messiah Fellowship Hall, 915 Oneida Street, Lewiston. Bailey has, for the past 50 years, written about the players, statistics, and history of Buffalo's professional teams. His topics cover the gamut, from the Buffalo Braves NBA basketball team to the Bills, Sabres, and Bandits. He is the author of 16 sports books, with the latest being published later this month, One Bills Drive. It's a look at the top 50 games played so far at the Orchard Park Stadium. Historical Association members say Bud speaks about sports in a way that few could rival, peppering his talks with funny behind-the-scenes anecdotes and little-known facts. He has given a series of talks at senior centers with colleagues Stu Boyer, who used to work in sports at WGRZ-TV and graduated from Syracuse University with Bailey in 1977. Bailey was a journalist who retired in 2017 after working 23 years at the Buffalo News. During that time, he won the Tom Borelli Award as the National Lacrosse League's Media Player Personality of the Year in 2011. Bailey will have some of his books for sale at the meeting. The community event is free and open to all, with donations greatly appreciated to help support the museum. Refreshments will be served. And that's all they wrote. And now, Vietnam Veterans of America Craft Show. The fourth annual fall craft show and basket raffle, hosted by Associates Vietnam's Veterans of America Chapter 77, will be held from 10 to 4 a.m. to 4 p.m. Saturday at the Gratwick Coast Firehouse, 110 Ward Road, Wheatfield. The craft show features unique handcrafted items created by local artisans. Baked goods and pizza slices will be sold on site. Associates VVA Chapter 77 was established to help veterans, active military members, and their families in times of need. And next, Jigsaw Puzzle Competition. Lockport Public Library will host a Jigsaw Puzzle Competition from 6 to 7:30 p.m. October 21st, just passed, next Tuesday. The challenge is to see which team can complete the most before time runs out. Teams of up to 6 people are allowed. Prizes are awarded. The puzzles are from Ravensburger. Advanced registration is required. One person per team can sign up online at thelockportlibrary.org or at the library. And that's all they wrote. You've been listening to a reading of articles and features from the current issues of the Lockport Union Sun and Journal. Your reader has been Robin. Thank you for listening.
Coming up next in the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service, we have a reading of the Wall Street Journal off-duty section. At 7 o'clock, we got Harper's Magazine, and at 8 o'clock, we have Sports Illustrated. Stay tuned for these readings and more throughout the day. You're listening to the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. Radio readers broadcast daily readings, 24 hours a day of newspapers, magazines, and books, to area people who are blind or have a print disability, who are provided reading radios. Our broadcast signal is provided at no charge by WNED. Radio reading broadcasts throughout the city of Buffalo, western New York, and southern Ontario's Niagara Peninsula. For more information on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service, call us at 716-821-5555. following program is intended for listeners who are blind, have low vision,